This weekend, I was I had to work on Canada Day, so I didn't get to any of the festivities, but I did watch a few video clips online, and I was a proud Canadian watching refugee after refugee celebrate their first day in Canada. And as you know, Westwood has sponsored two families, and it's been my joy and my delight to be part of that process. And thinking about refugees in general for the past couple years, I understood that refugees are people fleeing a difficult and often deadly situation. And then the more I thought about it and researched, I came to the conclusion that all of us, in a sense, are refugees, because we all have difficulties. We all have things in life that didn't go as we had planned or we had hoped. And so today's message is about a family that sought refuge. And I, as we go through it, try to make it personal for you. The story takes place in Ruth chapter 1, and I'll just start at verse 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab to live there. So a refugee is one that flees to escape. This family wasn't fleeing war, but they were fleeing famine. There wasn't food where they lived, and so they picked up their family and they moved. It was about a 7 to 10 day journey from Bethlehem to Moab. And they went there and they sought shelter from the famine. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. And so the place that they sought refuge was actually a place that brought more grief and more loss and more sorrow. And before we get too far into the story, if anything, I believe that Scripture is practical for us here today. So just take a minute to think, in your life, what disappointment, sorrow, loss, discouragement, whatever it is, what is it that you're seeking refuge from today? And if you're not seeking refuge from anything, everything is great in your life right now, I've lived long enough to know that that won't be the case forever. Because sorrow and loss and disappointments come with a lifetime guarantee. And as you think about where you go to seek refuge, the automatic things that we think of are substance abuse or workaholic or all these other things that people pour their energy in trying to relieve the pain, trying to flee from an unfortunate or difficult circumstance. But there's also places that we can flee to that are good places, places that on the surface seem like they're good and noble things to do. And for me, when my sister died, I was a student of Bible school, and I sought refuge in my studies. So, on the surface, very good, but not truly a place of lasting refuge, because I could only study for so long and so much, and then I was still face to face with the pain in my life. So, as we go on, think about your own circumstance. Verse 6, when Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. When her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and settled on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness, as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you would find rest in the home of another husband. And you'll see that I've underlined Lord there, because I want you to pay attention as we go through the story how many times the Lord is referenced. The story of Ruth is only 4 chapters long, and it's not a story of Ruth and Naomi and the other characters that we're going to meet. Fundamentally, the book of Ruth is a story of God's sovereignty. It's a story of God and his hand at work in the lives of these people. So I don't want to forget that as we go through. I picture this scene as they packed up their house or their tent, whatever they were living in, and they've come off a side street, and now they're on the main road. One road heads to Moab, deeper into the country of Moab, and the other one heads back to Bethlehem. And this is where they're at in this crossroad. And Naomi says to them, "Go back, go back, go back home." And I think why this is a significant scene in this story is because I think we've all been at a crossroad. We've come to the place where something's happened in our life, and our hopes and dreams, this is where we had planned our life would take us. And then we wake up one day and we realize that our life is heading in a completely different direction. Our hopes and dreams are this way, but reality has us going this way. And we're stuck in the middle. And what it causes us to do is to look at our life. We see the circumstances that are painful, the losses, the grief, whatever it is, we look at that and we say, "This is not good." And then unfortunately, the next thing that we look at is our understanding of God. And some of us can't sing this song that we sang today because we don't believe that God is a good, good father. We don't believe that because our circumstances tell us otherwise. We look at this and say, "This is not good. So how can God be good?" And we hold these two things in tension. My situation, my life, my hopes and dreams are that way, but I am this way. So what do we do with this ungood? What do we do with a God who says he's good? We hold these things in tension. Naomi says to her daughters, "Go back." Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud, and they said to her, "We will go back with you and your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. And even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait for them to grow up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters. It is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me." And as they wept aloud again, at this they wept aloud again. Then Orpha kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. Verse 15, "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Wherever you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you from me." When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. Two daughters-in-laws, almost identical circumstances, both Moabites, both married Israeli men from Bethlehem, and both of them died. Two daughters-in-laws, same situation, two very, very different choices. One chose to go back and go back to her family and to her gods. The other one, Ruth, chose to go with Naomi back to Bethlehem. And I think why that's so significant is what Ruth says. She doesn't say, "I'm going with Naomi and her God." She says, "Your God, Naomi, is now my God." So lots of us in this room grew up in Christian homes, have Christian friends, have hung around the church long enough to know people that have a deeply personal relationship with God. Yet hanging around them isn't going to hold you when your life becomes ungood. Their faith is their faith. Their God is their God. You are their friend, and Lord willing, they'll be there with you to walk through whatever you're walking through. But there comes a time and place when your faith has to become your faith, that your God is your God, not your parents' God, not your friend's God, not your church's God. You need to decide at this crossroad if God is going to be your God, because that changes everything, and it did for Ruth. Verse 19, so the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the woman exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi." And Naomi means pleasant, is what her name means. "Don't call me pleasant. Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara," which means bitter, "because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." And some people, when they talk about Naomi, they say that she's a bitter old woman. They throw her under the bus and say she's lost her faith, she has no concept of God and his work in her life. And I would wholeheartedly disagree with that. I don't think she's bitter. I think she's real. I think Naomi has come to terms with the reality of her ungood and has wrestled that through with her belief in a good God. Otherwise, why would Ruth have gone with her? How many people would leave their home, their family, everything they've ever known, and set off for a 7 to 10 day journey with a bitter mother-in-law? There's mother-in-law jokes for a reason, right? She wouldn't do it unless something in Naomi's life resonated to the very core of who Ruth was and said, "What she has, I need." And that's her God. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem at the barley harvest was to begin. So bitter life, bitter events in her life, but she's not a bitter person. How is that possible? How did she live those years in Moab and the famine before that? So at least a decade, if not longer. How did Naomi hold the ungood with the goodness of God? How did she do that? I think the key is found in Scripture. Woven throughout Scripture is an unguarded type of prayer known as lament. To lament is to ask why and why not, as well as what are you doing, God, and where are you? To lament is to pour out our hearts, holding nothing back. It is to pray without trying to be more full of faith than we actually are. Lament is prayer that honors the honesty of pain and anger, while also honoring the truth that God is the one who reigns and whose love never fails. Lament holds in tension all the suffering that seems to make no sense with a determination to believe that God is just. Lament draws us near to God when we are tempted to turn away. And lament remembers who God is even when you cannot see the truth of who he is in your midst. Part of that quote is on the handout for today. And I think as a church, we don't do lament well. We don't like this uncomfortableness between what is ungood to our eyes and so painful to us with the goodness of God. We don't know how to sit there. We don't like to be uncomfortable. I have a son who loves Christmas dinner and Thanksgiving dinner because he's a huge turkey and mashed potato fan. And one year we had family for Christmas. My mom was there, and she always takes the standard photo of everybody at the table ready to eat our turkey dinner. So Jonathan showed up, like fancy dress shirt, sleeves rolled up, iron pressed, ready to go. And I said to him, "You look sharp. Well done." So my mom takes the pictures of the family. And then as I'm getting up to take something to the table, I look down, and he is wearing his oldest, rattiest sweats under the table. I'm like, "What are you doing?" And he says, "Mom, I didn't want to be uncomfortable when I ate too much." And very simple illustration, but we don't do uncomfort well. We don't do pain well. We don't do sorrow and grief well. We try to run, we try to flee, and we try to seek refuge in anything else. The book of Ruth is a story of God's sovereignty and love in the midst of loss and grief. And we need to reconcile those two things that are so opposite, because that's the reality of our life. Pain and loss come with lifetime guarantees. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out and entered a field and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she was working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they answered. Boaz asked the overseer of his harvesters, "Who does that young woman belong to?" That's a great question. It's a great question before you date someone, and it's a great question before you work for someone. Who does that person belong to? Because we know the answer. She belongs to Naomi. She's the Moabite that came over. Everybody died. She's the grieving widow. That's who she is. But we know something that Boaz didn't know at that time. Who does she belong to? She belongs to the Lord. She doesn't belong to Naomi and Naomi's God. She belongs to her God, because Naomi's God has become her God. Verse 6, the overseer replied, "She is the Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters.' She came into the field and has remained here from morning until now, except for a short rest in the shelter." So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the women. I have told the men not to lay a hand on you. And whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." Boaz is a very wise man. I think Boaz understands grief. Grief is best healed in company, in community. And Boaz tells Ruth, "Stay with my women. Stay here. Stay and work with these people. We are your community. We will come alongside you." He could have sent her away. He could have sent her with a food stamp to go to the local store and get food, but he didn't. He said, "Stay. We will provide space for you." And I think, again, as a church, we don't always do that. We don't provide space and alongsideness with people who are grieving. At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She asked him, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" Boaz replied, "I've been told about all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." That's a great line. "Under whose wings you have come to take refuge." I spent some time in the emergency department, and I've seen parents there with their kids. And without fail, it's this. When the parent is there with their child, they are under their wing, caring. The kid's situation ranges in desperation, depending on why they're there. But the image of coming and taking refuge under someone's wing, it's a powerful picture of what Boaz describes Ruth doing with God. Verse 14, at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here, have some bread, and dip it in the wine vinegar." When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. As she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men, "Let her gather among the sheaves and don't reprimand her. Even pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up, and don't rebuke her." So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. There is value in grief to be doing something. There's value when someone is grieving to come alongside them and do something. Doesn't matter what it is. There's value in community. Shared grief lightens the load. It doesn't make it all better, but it's shared. And from that sharing deepens relationship, deepens intimacy, and it deepens community. Verse 19, her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. "The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz," she said. "The Lord bless him." Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. She added, that man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers. The concept of guardian redeemer is fabulous in this book. And there are, on the back of the teaching outline, there's some questions and stuff that you can look at this week if you want to pursue that further. Guardian redeemer. It's an Old Testament concept, a Hebrew word. Originally, it's in Leviticus 25, if you wanted to look it up. But it's a legal term for one who has the obligation to redeem a relative in serious difficulty. So an obligation to redeem a relative in serious difficulty. And as you read through the rest of the Bible and you get to the Gospels, Jesus becomes the ultimate guardian redeemer. And his redemption is not just a difficulty we're in. We're dead in our sin. And Jesus is the one who redeems us. And Boaz is a picture of that for Naomi and for Ruth. Chapter 3. I skipped a bunch of verses in here, and I should let you know that Naomi and Ruth have had this conversation, and Naomi has told Ruth this is what she is to do. And it's going to sound weird and culturally not relevant for us, but it was very appropriate in that context. So chapter 3, verse 7. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man. He turned, and there was a woman lying at his feet. "Who are you?" he asked. "I am your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family." That's a very appropriate way in her context for Ruth to ask Boaz to marry her. He's identified as one that could marry her and redeem her family, and so she's saying, will you do it? Probably don't recommend this. You know, not a lot of guys lying around in grain fields, but probably not the best way to ask someone to marry you. But in their context, what I read said that Boaz, because he was so much older than Ruth, he would never presume that she would want to marry him. And so for her to initiate, it was the cultural way of saying, I would like you to redeem us, please. So that's what she did. Verse 10, the Lord bless you, my daughter, he replied. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character. Although it is true that I'm the guardian redeemer of the family, there is another who is more closely related than I. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to do his duty as your guardian redeemer, good, let him redeem you. But if he's not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Chapter 4. Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat down there, just as the guardian redeemer he had mentioned came along. Boaz said, come over here, my friend, and sit down. So he went over and sat down. Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, sit here. And so they did. Then he said to the guardian redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me, so I will know, for no one has the right to do it except you, and I am next in line. I will redeem it, he said. Then Boaz said, oh, by the way, on the day you buy land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. At this, the guardian redeemer said, then I cannot redeem it, because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it. The thing about this first guardian redeemer is that he doesn't have a name. He never has a name in the story. And I think why that's significant is because the places that we run to are places of refuge. We need to name them because ultimately they will not redeem us. And so we run to them thinking that they're our guardian redeemer. We run thinking that this is going to make it all better. And they say initially, I will redeem you. I will redeem you, I will redeem you. And then ultimately, I cannot do it. So there's power for us when we name who we're running to for refuge, who we're trying to seek refuge in, who are we relying on to be our guardian redeemer. Now, in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one part took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel. So the guardian redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it yourself," and he removed his sandal. Verse 9, then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, "Today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. Today you are witnesses." This is a character man. Boaz is doing all of this to maintain the name of someone who is not himself. All the glory, all the name, all the lineage will go to Ruth's dead husband. And Boaz is willing to do that, making himself a servant for this man. And what I find ironic is that Boaz, who's named, is doing this for the name of someone who's already died, and the guardian redeemer, who is unnamed, is the one that should have stepped up to the plate. So Boaz is a quality man. And as a mom, girls, don't marry someone who isn't a quality guy. Go for character. Verse 13, so Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son, and they named him Obed. And right away, I have Matthew 1:1 up here. It's the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and then further down, Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David, and Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, and Mary was the mother of Jesus, who is called the Messiah, who is the Redeemer, who is the guardian Redeemer of all of us because of the cross. And why I have this up here, why I think this is so significant, is because I'm willing to bet that in the middle of her grief and sorrow, Ruth says, "God's forgotten me." Ruth says, "God doesn't know that I'm here. He doesn't care about me." But when we, having the advantage of Matthew chapter 1, we say that Abraham, to Jesus the Messiah, God's entire story, who's in the middle of it? It's Ruth. So while we may not see God in our midst, God's ways are not our ways. His thoughts are higher than ours. So when we don't see God in the darkness, in the midst of our ungood, we need to rest in the goodness of God, even when we can't see it. And that's what faith is. So from King David, I want to end with something that he wrote. And King David, his great-grandmother was Ruth. And at that Christmas dinner, I looked around the table and I saw my two kids. And they had their arm on the table with their arm out like this. And I don't know if you can see my thumb. It's not a big deal, but they were talking and eating with their thumb like this. And I flashed back to when I was a little girl sitting at a table with my grandfather. And my grandfather held his thumb in that exact way. And I've caught myself doing it. And I thought, how is that possible? Both these boys were born after my grandfather died. How is that possible? And I just said, somehow, something gets passed down from generation to generation. And why I love this genealogy is because Ruth was redeemed. Ruth was redeemed, and out of her came the Redeemer. And more importantly, for the life of King David, Ruth trusted a God when she couldn't see him in her midst. And David spent most of his adult life running from people who were trying to kill him, his own family included. And so King David wrote a lot of laments. And in the life of lament, where the ungood was in tension with the goodness of God, this is what King David wrote. And I'd like you to stand as I read it this morning. As we do, ask yourself this: to where do you run when life gets difficult? In whom or in what do you hope to find refuge? It's King David speaking. Keep and protect me, O God, for in you I have placed my trust and found refuge. I said to the Lord, Lord, you are my Lord. I have no good besides you, because he's a good, good father. The Lord is the portion of my inheritance, my cup. He is all I need. I will bless the Lord who has counseled me. Indeed, my heart, my mind instructs me in the night. I have set the Lord continually before me. Because he is at my right hand, I will not be shaken. Therefore, my heart is glad and my glory, my inmost self rejoices. My body too will dwell confidently in safety, for you will not abandon me. You will show me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. In your right hand, there are pleasures forevermore. How did King David, how was he able to write that in the midst of the grief and the difficulties and the sorrow in his life? It's because King David knew that a change in circumstances is not what hope is. Hope is a person, and that person is Jesus Christ.